Thank you. I'll do a quick roll call for you, John.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. On today's STI Trademark Clearinghouse call, we have John Nevitt, Zahid Jamil, Mike Rodenbach, Jeffrey Eckhaus, Mark Partridge, Santos Kamaitis, Greenberg, Olivier Sabin-Leblanc, Kathy Kleinman, Jeff Newman, Phil Corwin. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Marika Konings, Amy Statos, Liz Gaster, Kurt, Glenda Saint-Géry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. And apologies, we have David Maher and Wendy Seltzer. If you could please just remind everyone to state their names when speaking. Thank you. Over to you, John.
Great. Thank you very much. So
John, it's Alan. The voices are cutting out a lot of the time.
Okay.
And there's some slapping in the background. I don't know what it is.
I could unequivocally state that I am not responsible for the slapping.
Okay. Is anyone else hearing it, or is it just me?
I hear it as well. This is Konstantinos.
I hear it, too. I put myself on mute. This is Jeff. Not that it's me doing the slapping. I'm just saying I'm putting it on mute.
Thanks for the clarification, Jeff. John, try again. Last time you were talking, I only heard about a third of what you were saying.
Okay, is that better?
Right now it is.
Okay. Okay, so just on in terms of ground rules, we have a couple groups that have alternates on the phone. I just want to figure out if the alternate is representing, if the two or one members are on the phone as well, and just figure out the rights of the alternates. Sounds like from an ALAC perspective, Alan, you'll be the participating party?
We would prefer if alternates could speak, but I understand the ground rules. We're not. We're that they not, so I presume that's the rules. If they change, let me know.
Okay. The NCSG, do you have alternates available? Or?
I don't think our alternates are on the call.
Okay. Wendy's not on, so they could be.
Good point. Wendy is on an airplane and sends her regrets.
Okay. Registries. The alternate's not here. Registrar, the alternate's not here. BC?
Mike is the alternate, and I'm the lead.
There's two. There are two, I think, with one alternate, right?
Yeah, sorry. Forgive me. There are two with one alternate. That's right.
Okay, so you and Mike are
Mike,
both
do you, Mike, yeah, Mike, do you want to speak?
That's correct, and Phil is the alternate.
Phil's the alternate. Okay, IPC... Christine is away, I think, right? And then ISPC. I didn't hear anyone.
Yeah. Could I ask if someone from staff could send out the link to the Adobe Connect if we're using that? I can't find it in past emails.
Okay. If someone could do that, that would be great.
Thank you.
Okay. So then... just one other matter I wanted to raise. I recently, in the last few minutes, circulated a draft proposal coming out of our meeting yesterday on the URS. Obviously, today we're talking about the IP clearinghouse or trademark clearinghouse, but I wanted to make sure, if you don't get that, to let me know, and to thank the folks who helped putting that together. So hopefully that'll be some helpful document in reaching consensus at our next meeting or two on the URS. If anyone has any questions about that, feel free to reach out to me. Okay, so on the IP clearinghouse, or trademark clearinghouse, we're going to walk through the consensus document that's loaded on Adobe that Zahid circulated this morning, and we could just take them one at a time. Zahid, do you want to take the lead on that since you circulated it?
Yeah, that's fine. I could do that. Yeah, if you look at number one, which is separation into two parts, review, approval, or repository and language, we see, and please correct me if I'm wrong, everybody across the board seems to agree to that. The ISPC is the only one I've seen in the comments saying that there's no need for doing that.
By the way, this is Paul McGrady. I joined the call late. I couldn't find the number, and I can't get into Adobe. My tech folks are working on it. I apologize for my tardiness.
Okay. No problem. Thanks, Paul. All right. I'll take a cue, Jeff.
Yeah, I just want it clear somewhere that it's one database that the registries and registrars have to deal with. So I didn't see it in the chart. I'm not sure exactly where that is. So we could separate the roles, but just make it clear that it's one entity that the registries and registrars deal with.
Okay, any comments on that? If not, Marika, could you put that in the notes?
Is that number two? Is that the second one?
I think in number two it says centralized database, but I guess we could clarify it more, yeah?
Jeff, does that address your concerns?
Centralized database for maintaining the trademarks and providing Sunrise. Yeah, just make it...
Do you want to say one centralized database?
Correct.
Okay,
thank you.
Sure.
John, this is Mark Partridge. Could you put me in the queue, please?
Yes, go ahead.
I got it, Acrobat.
Go ahead, Mark. You're next.
The chart that's there didn't seem to pick up the comments that from the IPC that we sent out yesterday, and I'm concerned that maybe they didn't get properly distributed or sent. But on this particular, so I've resent it, and I hope people will get it this time. The point on number one that it the IPC's view is that the responsibilities could be divided, providing there's one centralized database for submission of information and for use by the registry. Similar to what Jeff's saying, to also make sure it's one database for submission.
Okay.
Thanks.
What do you mean by one database for submission? It's Alan.
Right. That there's one place to, for the parties who are submitting information to send it. That's the main point of the clearinghouse, is that there's one place to make the submission.
Okay, so you're saying in addition to one final database, you're saying the submission point must always also be the same.
That's the idea. Yes, that's the idea behind making the clearinghouse efficient, so there's simply one place where you deposit.
Okay.
It's Alan. The only comment to that is that needs to be done factory in respect for languages. In other words, you can't say there is one place to deposit it and you must do it in English.
That certainly seems fine. No problem with that.
Okay, if you could note that. I've got Kathy and then Jeff Eckhouse.
Oh, sorry. Hi.
Okay. This is Kathy, and there appears to be agreement on number three that says that there'll be regional validation services or regional examining services. The goal, which we've talked about many times, being to get that verification and that as close to the country as possible, that there wouldn't be one all-knowing authority that knows every country's trademark laws and every country's description of goods and services process and every country's classes, like international classes. And so that was the purpose of the regional, is to have different places to submit the data that would know the trademark law of the different regions of the different countries.
But doesn't that go to validation, not where the trademark holders file the trademark information?
Are we creating a third entity now?
No, it was two, wasn't it?
Regardless, are we on number two or three?
We are on number two.
Okay.
I guess I'm on number three because I thought number two was the database that communicates with the registries.
Okay. Jeff, do you have a comment on two or three?
Yeah, it's actually on one, two, and three. How's that? Yeah, what I want to say is I think people are mixing and matching, and I think that, I guess Mark had mentioned it and Jeff, you had mentioned it. I just want to be clear that, so the separation into two parts was, one would be the validation piece, and one would just be the other entity that disseminated the data. So there was no piece, there was no idea that it would be two separate databases or two separate ideas, and that is, I guess, one and two combined on that I don't think there was any change in that, and I think we're all in agreement on both of those. So I just want to be clear what the separation was. It wasn't into separate databases. It was just separate entities on there.
So in the, if I could summarize, in the front end, the IP holders want to be able to provide all their trademark information to one entity. And on the back end, the registries and registrars want to deal with one database.
Right.
Then the question is, what's in the middle for validation, and should there be a separate entity that does that, and should that separate entity or entities be on a regional basis or not? Is that accurate?
I think there was one – well, yes, but there was one other part, which I think the staff proposal was, the one database. Everyone would connect to that one data – would use that one database, but the person who you would connect to was different than the person who was collecting all the information that you submitted to and was the validator. So I think I'm saying what you're saying, but I didn't bring in three into it. I'm just going to leave three alone for the moment.
Okay. Could someone send Paul McGrady the call-in information for the U.S. with the
I found a guy.
Oh, you got it? Okay.
I don't have access to Adobe, so for some reason I'm in the Miami office today, and it's not working here. So if I need to say something, I'm just going to rudely jump in. How's that?
That's fine. Zahid.
Thank you. Just a question. So if you're trying to register a trademark and you're in a region, which is in Asia, whatever, wouldn't you be sort of presenting that information in your own language, in your own format, to the regional marks verification service provider first, and then that's where it then goes to the centralized database afterwards after validation? Because otherwise what would happen is that you probably have to send it to a centralized database or whatever entity, then they send it to the validation, which is separate, then it comes back to them. Maybe we're doing that, you know. I don't know how that'll work. Just asking a question there.
Hey, Alan?
Yeah, I think we're talking about the level of detail we don't need to talk about. I think we've established some principles. I don't know whether we all agreed on them, but the principles seem to be there shall be a single database that is used for the ultimate repository of the information and querying information in it or sending out IP claims or whatever, that we want, or at least some people here want, a single point of entry into it to contribute documents, contribute marks, and languages must be addressed in that case. And then the issue is who and how do they get validated, and I would suggest that we just put a principle saying the validation should be as close to the region as possible with someone familiar with the issues. Regardless of whether we have multiple contracts or multiple validators, there's going to be some work that's subcontracted locally. That's going to be the only way to handle paper documents. So okay. I don't think we need to architect this in detail other than to set the principle.
Does anyone disagree with Alan?
This is Kathy. It depends what the principle is of the central point. This is a new idea coming in of one place to submit in all languages. I think you've just increased the cost exponentially.
Let me just stop you. That is not a new idea. That was the IRT idea, was one place. That was what the trademark holders have been asking for forever. But go ahead, sorry.
Again, the concept of the regional so yes, there is disagreement on that point, because the regional verification and then that ability to translate an array of trademarks and from an array of different domains into kind of a common format through the database. So different visions here.
It's Alan. I'm not sure it is. When I go into the Japan Airlines homepage, I then am asked what country am I in and what language do I want to speak into, and then I go to somewhere. I don't know where that next page comes from, but it's all served out of a common point from my perspective as a user.
Okay.
Jeff Newman?
Yeah, I was just going to say, in previous Sunrises, if someone submitted and IDNs have been launched with Sunrise Processes, if someone submitted an Egyptian trademark that had a, you know, that could be matched, it didn't need to be from the region. Again, the question is not how something becomes a registration. It's once it's a registration, is there an ability of the authenticator to authenticate that is a registration? Not how it got to be a registration. So if it's hieroglyphics or if it's any other kind of language, if it looks like an identical match, and it's identical match, then that's all you need to know.
Okay, anyone else on this point?
Hi, this is Paul. I just want to be clear that the IPC's position that all of the regional validating or authenticating should be under one contract with one organization that has the capability worldwide. And I understand the notion of regional validators, but from our point of view, that creates all sorts of quality, multi-contractual issues, and it makes sense to find one vendor who can do all of that. So that's that's what the IPC would like to stick to.
Okay. Any other comments?
Yes, but the idea of the regional clearinghouse is that, there are so many differences, even tiny differences in trademark laws. We need to have the authorities to be able to verify those differences. I mean, one central authority will not be in the position to do all that. Even WIPO is not doing that and lists all different registrations and countries separately. So I really think that the idea of regional is very important for us to maintain consistency in what is being listed. And since the clearinghouse is all about efficiency, especially for the registers and registrars, the one centralized database will perform, allow and ensure this efficiency.
Okay, so it sounds like we have consensus that there should be one database that the registries and registrars are dealing with. I didn't hear any dispute that there should be one entity that the trademark holders will submit their information to so they don't have to do multiple. And then the issue is whether there should be multiple verification entities or one verification entity with subcontracts based on regional differences. And is that an implementation detail that ICANN could work through?
So what I heard you, I'm sorry, this is Kurt. Kathy can go first if she wants. Sorry.
No, I'd like to think about it and bring it back to the developing country people who raised the issue with us.
Okay, fair enough.
And also I think it's something we should revisit when we get farther down on the chart to the notice of the IP claims, because one of the issues is not just identical match, which raises its own set of issues, but it's not just identical match, but what the description, what information we're going to be providing the registrant, including, hopefully, a description of goods and services. What is this trademark owner claiming this trademark for? And the closer we are to the regional verification, the better the translation into the registry database will be. I don't know if that makes sense, but every country, even Canada, doesn't use international classes of goods and services. So knowing what to pluck out of that trademark application to put the registrant on fair notice is going to be a process of translation. And again, the closer we get it to the trademark laws, the better the nuances are that will be passed on. So again, footnote here, can we wait until we talk about notice?
Alan?
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that regardless of how the contracts are done, there are going to have to be experts in local trademark law in 100 and X countries, and that's either the requirement of the single contractor or the multiple contractors. If there is no single contractor in the world who can do it, I mean, that's an implementation issue.
So I think you were in agreement with what I said, and Kathy is withholding...
Yep.
That until, reaching out to our community. All right, so let's move on to number four. Any comments, thoughts?
I think that's a duplicate of number one, isn't it?
Okay. Number five. Question is whether there should be a contract with ICANN or not. I'm not sure where this minimum standards but not a contract came in from for the registries and registrars.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too. You took my comment. This is Jeff.
Okay.
But we wanted a contract.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is Zahid speaking.
Sorry, just to give her, you want a contract, Jeff? That's the question. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, very much so. We did
okay,
not want.
Perfect.
We did not like the way it was treated as an accreditation. We want a strict contract.
I apologize for that. I think that works great. Thanks.
Okay, I've got Alan.
Number five is talking about the validation services. My understanding is what we discussed the other day is we definitely wanted a contract from ICANN with who is providing the overall service. Either the validation providers have contracts with ICANN, but based on the previous statement, it sounds like the validation provider will be part of the overall organization and perhaps subcontracted out. So I thought our issue was the overall service must be under contract, not accredited. Those contracts may flow down. So ICANN will not necessarily have a contract with the validation service.
Jeff, do you have a response?
Yeah,
go ahead.
This is Kirk. Get me in the queue after Jeff responds.
The way we saw it on the IRT was that there was going to be one entity selected, and that entity could subcontract if it wanted to the authentication role. Now that we're talking about two entities, I think the database needs to have a strict contract with ICANN. I don't know about the validating agent. I guess they would too, because I guess you want a way to have strict guidelines on how to enforce the minimum requirements, but I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm up in the air on this one.
Okay. Kurt, shed some light.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just going to shed dimness. There's a point I made in an earlier meeting that to the extent you can be really clear in whatever your final product is. I'm not clear why accreditation isn't adequate. So if there's, but I'm not, I'm for either way. So I'm just saying, if you want to advocate that position, be clear in your product why instances where accreditation might fail. That would be really helpful in carrying the day there.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Kirk. Can I turn this around a little bit? I know you're going to appreciate it, but I think the last time you represented to us that the board really didn't want a contract but wanted more of an accreditation. Maybe it'll help to understand why the board was so concerned with having that contract, and then maybe we can respond to those concerns. Like, what in their mind or what in the staff's mind is the difference between an accreditation and a contract?
Yeah, I don't know. I can only shed more dimness there.
Well, we have both in the registrar community. We get accredited, and we have a contract.
And ICANN, what's ICANN's relationship with, say, WIPO and NAF? Why wouldn't that work here? So I think it might not work here. I think it's important to say, why not?
Do we need to break five into two parts between, if we're talking about two functions?
Well, five and six. There's six. Six is broken.
Okay, six is the other one.
Yeah. So here's my view, Kurt. WIPO and National Arbitration, they don't really have an operational role with respect to registration of domain names they have a dispute provider role, which is kind of separate and outside the whole registration process. But in this, we're talking about sunrise processes, we're talking about IP claims, talking about potential pre-registration services for URS. I see these as more operational than being the dispute provider, third-party kind of independent thing. And therefore, I think the distinction is that when you have an operational role, you really need a strict contract. Whereas when you have kind of a third-party outsider type role, like WIPO and National Arbitration Forum for a dispute process, I think that can be more of a offhand approach. But this has got to be, as a registry, I need to have certainty that they're going to operate to certain service levels, and there needs to be enforcement actions against them Whereas as a registry, I'm not sure I care that WIPO takes 2 days longer to decide a UDRP case. Does that make sense?
Well, you could have strict guidelines without a contract, though, right?
Well, but you need legal enforcement, and I'm not sure how loose an accreditation is when whether that could really be. It's different, right? There's accreditation that they have with WIPO, which is a lot different than accreditation they have with the registrar. The accreditation they have with the registrar is a strict contract that you can enforce. The accreditation they have with WIPO is kind of a letter saying, okay, yeah, you guys are accredited to provide these services. We need strict guidelines. We need an agreement. Whether you call it an accreditation agreement or whether you call it a contract, that's what we need.
Okay. Any other? I have Sahin.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the I'm updating the table as I'm going along, and it seems that on 5 and 6, everybody says yes, so I guess we got violent agreement.
Hey, Konstantinos?
Yes, just to add, from a purely, from a law point of view, the contract is more strict, and I would agree with Jeff that we need to have compliance requirements that are the same across the board, across the validators and across, so we really need to opt for the contract. It's more binding and it provides more guarantees.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I think the problem is here we use the terms sometimes interchangeably. Registrars are accredited, yet they're part of the contracted party's house, and we treat the RAA, which is an accreditation agreement, as a contract. So I'm not sure there's a big difference depending on how we word these documents.
Okay. Anyone else? See?
That was from before. I'm just taking it.
Okay. Anyone else? Anyone not on Adobe? All right. Sounds like there's more consensus. There's a consensus that we should have contracts for both sides of the of the equation. Okay, number 7. Saheed, do you want to walk through that one?
Oh. Sorry, I was on mute. Identical matches, there's seems to be a difference between the definition that was in the staff report and the one that is available here, which was in the IRT report. There seems to be several agreements across the board with no objection from the ISPC. The only one was the NCFC saying that they needed to review this and get back to the larger group. The
and at large.
The BC, I'm sorry, and at large. And at large. The BC's view on this was that they wanted also typographical errors or typographicals to be included with it.
Okay. Comments? I've got Alan and then Jeff.
First of all, we asked for some clarification. The wording in the middle of this definition about being spelt out, I want to make sure I understand. You know, does that mean someone replaces the hyphen with the letters H-Y-P-H-E-N? So I'd like to know what that means. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense in how what domain names normally look like. We have an objection to the plural, which I don't believe was in the IRT report and seems to have been added. I may be mistaken on that. And we strongly object to meaning and oral. It's just impossible to implement given the number of languages, the number of meanings things have, the different pronunciations that are used in different languages of any given character string.
Okay. I've got Jeff. I've got a whole bunch of people. Right.
Okay. Yes. So let me support Alan just said. I didn't even know plural got in there, and I apologize for not even noticing. It should be exactly what's in the IRT report. Not sure. You know. Again, I feel like I'm rehashing discussions that we had for weeks in the IRT, but I know most of you weren't there. But essentially, there's no way for us to do typographical errors or any entity to do it because, again. And I think the other thing the BC has in their paper, which isn't on this chart, is one marks containing the word. And the example I used with some people from Microsoft was that, you know, how do I know the difference between whether a window or window cleaning. Windows is a Microsoft trademark. How do I know that window cleaning is not an infringement or something that's an error? Or there's no way for a database to make that kind of distinction. I'm not sure why it's added in here. The IRT didn't recommend it. The business constituency supported the IRT report. It just seems to me that they're adding a whole bunch of complexities here that are new ads, and that wasn't the role of this group. New ads should not be the role.
John, this is Mark. Let me, when you had a chance.
Sure, I'll add you. I've got Kathy and then Mike, Zahid, and then Mark.
Kathy, I want to echo what you know, which is that there's great concern in NCSG about what identical match is, and a number of people say identical match is identical match. I think ALAC raises some great points as well. I wanted to further complicate the issue by raising the issue of design marks. It was interesting in some kind of offline conversations. I had just assumed design marks were not part of anything, were not part of the clearinghouse, because design marks are a right given to the trademark owner for sometimes not even a word, but if there are words, for a word or words in the context of a certain type of calligraphy, a certain type of color, a certain type of logo or design presentation. And now I'm hearing that there are some who would like to protect those words within the design as part of the string match of the clearinghouse. So I just kind of want to put that out there as well, that we're looking at identical match across just text marks or also across design marks, and that will influence our review, the NCSG review of the issue.
Okay. We've got Mike.
thanks, John. It's Mike Rodenbaugh. I was just not clear in reading this, and this is the first SCI call I've participated on, so you might have discussed it, but just not clear, you know, what really identical match means from what it says here. It could very well mean Yahoo Sports in addition to Yahoo, which I think it should mean, but I think the IRT report came out otherwise. I don't see any harm, really, in having additional notices go out. Jeff, you seem to imply that the database is making decisions as to what's an infringement or not. Obviously, it's not. It's making a decision whether there's a record or not. If so, display a notice. If not, say that there's not. I mean, it's not complicated. What goes in there, though, and what is an identical match really does need to be clarified. If Yahoo Sports and Yahoo Finance and all these other phrases are not going to be included as an identical match on the word Yahoo, then it is not going to be nearly as effective a remedy for any brand, really. It's almost worthless, basically, if all you're preventing is identical matches. So then the only other point I was going to make is, you know, Jeff, you keep saying that, you know, new, this is a new ad or something, and, you know, this is a new group. We valiantly tried to come to consensus and failed, and now we're trying to come to consensus. So please don't say that things are new ads. I mean, things have been taken away, obviously, as well. Thanks.
What's the staff proposal on this one? What's the default?
Hi, this is Amy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we actually addressed the specifics of what would achieve identical mark or identical match.
Good. Thanks, Amy. I've got Zahid and then Mark Partridge.
Actually, I think some of us jumped into the line, too, again, to address other comments.
Okay. I've got Zahid and then Mark Partridge, and then I'll add the others in.
Thanks. This is Zahid. Well, basically, the DC position has been that we would, you know, like to see if you add an S or you take away an S to a brand name, basically, and say that will not eventually lead to an IP claims notice going out. I just want to say that is a position that the DC members feel that then it doesn't really help having an IP claim service. But you just add an S, and I know this sort of extends to all of the typographical errors, but at least with the addition or the deletion of an S or, you know, plurals or singulars, that might become an issue. And I think we're just trying to address those S's, really. With regard to typographicals, again, it's just a claim notice going out. It's not, there's no chilling effect as such, it's just a notice. And I think that it's fairly reasonable. I understand these are negotiating for this. The IRT did not do this, but, you know, we're trying to get, I agree with Mike, we're trying to get consensus in a new group here. Just wanted to mention that. But, you know, we're open to discussion, sure.
And again, Mark Partridge?
Yes, the IPC's position is that the IRT balance is the one we favor here. The identical match issue was debated at length, as Jeff points out, and you know, there's arguments to be made that it should simply be contains the letter string and should be very broad for reasons stated. This is not a block. It just gives notice. And viewed that way, it's a service to a good faith registrant to avoid disputes. It helps with the process of avoiding disputes if it's broader. The IRT position on matches was a compromise position that was narrower than that. It's not the position that many brand owners favor, but it's the position supported at this point by the IPC.
Hey, go ahead.
John, this is Amy, too. Can I get in the queue?
Sure. Go ahead, Amy.
And the people on Adobe, perhaps?
Yep, I'm going down the list now.
Okay.
Amy, did you have a response to that point? Or?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just wanted, what staff had indicated, because we didn't specifically identify a identical per se, it's basically the idea was that it meant to, that the domain name would consist of complete and identical textual elements of the trademark. But we didn't define identical. The purpose was to be limited to identical marks is to ensure operational integrity. So there wasn't overly broad notifications.
Okay. All right, I've got Jeff Backhouse, Allen, and then Jeff Newman.
Okay, thanks. So I wanted to make just responses to Mike Rodenbaugh, to your piece about, hey, if you have Yahoo, you can't have, you know, why not have Yahoo Sports? And just from somebody who's been dealing a lot with trying to parse domain names and to parse the lettering on there. And from experience, I'll give you an example. We have, you know, for Enom, we have the trademark, and then we had some issues, and we found out that if you add some other letters to it, like people were sending letters to a company like Venom, you know, that includes the term. So it is very, very difficult. Exactly, yeah. And a whole bunch of other ones, which I don't want to get into, but just because you add an S or you add a letter to it, it completely changes the word. It changes the term. The trademark is not there. Like, I don't know, you know, how Coca-Cola is, but if they have the trademark for Coke, but then you add in, if you have something about Iron Coke, and that has to be, you know, something about a, you know, with steel, then it completely changes the term around, and it's no longer a trademark. So I'd be very, very weary about adding letters or adding extra terms onto it, because it does not necessarily mean that there's a trademark.
Alan?
Yeah, on that one, my recollection is that was part of the rationale for the URS, that the IP claims was not going to cover the variations, and that was up to a person to decide whether to take action on it or not. I would dispute what someone said of there isn't a chilling effect of just getting an IP claims notice. I think to many people it will be a significant chilling effect. Maybe not to a lawyer, but certainly to many others who might otherwise want to register a name, and this pop-up may well change their mind. And lastly, I again ask the question, what does spelt out mean?
Mm-hmm.
And can someone give a rationale for it? Because I do not understand it. I'm sure there were hours of discussion about it, but I didn't hear them.
Hey, but this is Paul. Can I get in the queue?
I can address that. This is
Jeff. Yeah, you're next anyway.
Yeah, okay. So let me address that question first, and then I'll make my points. Spelled out means for symbols like the ampersand sign, you would write in the word and. So if M&M, right, or if that's a plus, I guess. So you can't have a plus, but you can have M-A-N-D-M would be the spelled out. So the point I want to make is this has been done before. There have been at least 15 or 16 Sunrise processes since 2001, each of which have had the same rules for spelled out. I think it's really an implementation issue, but it's fairly well understood by those that have implemented it. what that means. And I think the IRT basically said, look, just what it did is it included the rules that were included in the latest ones for like .tel, .asia, .eu. So I think I don't really think there's that concern about what is spelled out mean. I think it's fairly well understood, and certainly I think here it's just short-formed on this chart, but there are pages of rules that registries have come out with. Be happy to send around those pages of rules, but this is the problem here we're having is with the short form in the chart that you're trying to paraphrase what it is, but I think it's fairly well understood. The other point I want to make about plurals is I think we're being a little bit you can't just say plural, because plural doesn't mean just add S. Even in the English language, it's S or ES, or if it's a word like alumnus, you know, the plural of alumnus is alumni. The plural of forum is fori. Right? So even in the English language, it's impossible to figure out what the plural of every word is. And in other languages, I don't even know what the plural of ASCII versions of a Chinese mark would be. I can't even contemplate that. So there are many reasons. The IRT, these were all in the IRT discussions and why we balanced it out. The other thing I got to mention is we're not talking only about IP claims here. We're talking about sunrise. And remember, if there was a sunrise, it has to be identical match, because that was the mark that they would be allowed to defensively register. So I hear you guys talking about IP claims, but we're talking about more than IP claims. We're talking about sunrise. And again, I just want to point out, this has been done before many times, never been an issue. I agree with Kathy that design marks should be shut out. I thought we had that in the IRC report. I could be very well wrong about it. I know we discussed it, but design marks should not be in for all the reasons Kathy mentioned. And pretty much every generic word has been incorporated into some design that you can then claim rights to, which I think is just not shouldn't be done.
Okay.
Anyway, that's my view.
All right, thanks. I'm getting conscious of the time. I've got Kathy, and now a whole bunch of new people want to start. So, Kathy, why don't you raise your points, and then we'll figure out where to cut off the queue. We're only on number 7 of 22.
I know this will surprise everybody, but I think Jeff just said it all, so I will take it out of my hand.
I'm sorry, number 7 of 11. Okay. I went all the way down to URS. Thank you.
I'm sorry, number 7. I'm sorry, we're changing numbers, John?
No. I said we're only on number 7 of 22. I went down to the bottom, but that's including the URS. All right, I've got Mike, Allen. Mike first, and Allen.
Real quick to respond to what Jeff and Allen were saying earlier, and just, you know, reiterate what me and what Mark Partridge are saying, is that there's no action that is taken other than a notice is sent out, okay? And that is a benefit, actually, to most people, not a chilling effect. And to the extent that it could be a chilling effect, I think that can be addressed in the content of the notice, which, personally, I'm willing to be very flexible on. I mean, you know, Kathy and Jeff Newman can write it together. I don't care, you know, as long as it goes out and has the facts. That's what's important, but it should very clearly say that, you know, you may not be infringing anybody's rights. I'd put that bold space in the first sentence, and I think that should alleviate the chilling effects argument that we keep hearing.
That addresses the claims, but not the sunrise point that Jeff made, right?
Well, in sunrise, so the point on that is the database can be used differently during sunrise or during a later, you know, lookup and notification process, right? During sunrise, it can only kick back yes answers on identical matches. During IP claims, it can kick back yes answers on a broader, even algorithmic design. And there certainly are sources. Google uses one. Yahoo uses one. Plenty of other people use them, including a lot of domain registrars, their domain lookup tools that have, you know, typo generator type of algorithms that do work and can be effective.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, Mike just made a good point that we don't have to use the same algorithm for all uses of the clearinghouse, which I don't think is something I considered, but is indeed a good point. I'll go back. I thank Jeff for the explanation. As I said, with spelt out, I was really just asking to understand it. The point that hasn't been mentioned by anyone is the issue of oral and meaning,
which I believe was in the IRT report. I don't remember if it was in the staff one, but has been brought up by a number of other people. We're strongly against it just because of the difficulty of doing it properly.
Jeff, could you respond? Was that in the IRT report? I see it in the VC comments.
Yeah, this is Jeff. It was not. Oral and meaning were not in the IRT report in this section. Oral and meaning only came into play when the algorithm was applied to someone applying at a top level for a string.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
But that was not in this section.
Okay,
thank you.
Constantinos.
Yes, the only thing I would just like to say is, that I can see SG fully agrees with what Jeff is saying, and also for the design marks that we should not include them because, from a law point of view at least, when you register for a design mark, you don't necessarily get protection of the text itself. So if we allow design marks, and because we will only use their text when it comes to domain names, basically the clearinghouse will be granting rights that do not exist under normal circumstances.
Okay. So, Vahid, last point.
But by the way, this is Paul. I asked if I could be in the queue as well.
Oh, you did indeed. I apologize, Paul. All right, Vahid and then Paul.
Thank you. So I just want to reiterate the point that as far as meaning and oral is concerned, I think that is going to be difficult if it's going to be part of an IP claim service. But I think as far as type squatting and something that Mike mentioned about algorithms, it could be possible. To what extent is that impossible? Maybe I can staff to tell us. That would be one way to go. I understand that there's violent differences of opinion between various people on the call here, but it seems to me, at the very least, there seems to be an agreement on the IRT definition. So maybe that's one thing we can actually move forward. The DC did support the IRT recommendation, so at least that much is there. But we have additional comments that we would like to make and see if that works. But at least on the IRT definition, it seems to me to be a consensus across the board.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah, and I don't know who said this. It was 7 or 8 speakers ago, but somebody mentioned a point that I think is really important here, which is the definition of matching was done in the context of a mandatory URS, and that perhaps the definition of match was relaxed by the IRT because they believed that the URS would be mandatory and that the other recommendations would be accepted as a whole. So as a result of that, I'm going to suggest that we table this issue until the issue of whether or not the URS will be mandatory is finally resolved, because I don't think that the IPC can take a final position on this issue until we know whether or not the URS will be mandatory.
Okay. So the bottom line in this one, it sounds like the IRT recommendation for identical match is acceptable to most, if not all. And then the question is, some of these add-ons, the design mark, there's some complaints about that, in opposition to that, typographical errors, oral and meaning, and plurals are still at issue.
And what about also, like, mark plus generic terms, Yahoo Sports?
Okay, so that's another...
I think Enom's statement was rather telling.
Yeah,
Enom Venom.
I doubt you're going to get consensus on that, but let's put it in there as an issue. Okay, moving on to number 8. Eligibility of the mark, whether it's nationally registered, court validated, is the issue. And to some extent, this is related to number 7 and to the point that I think Mike made that, you know, should the database collect more information and then use it, and how it's used might be dictated by the user and not collect the data. But I'll take a cue on this. Alan?
Yeah, at large's position was we could accept court-validated ones if there is adequate inclusion in them of the geographic region it applied to and the type and the class of mark. But we do note that the amount of work required to validate such things is going to be significantly more. We're talking about reading a court judgment, which may be hundreds of pages,
and validating that there isn't a judgment following it which have reversed it, and we would want to make sure that the fees are set accordingly if these remarks are allowed.
Okay. Any other comments? Do we have consensus on this? Jeff Newman.
Could someone give me an example of a court-validated judgment of common law rights? Who are we trying to protect here? Like, why is this a big issue? Again, has it been an issue for the 15 Sunrise processes that have been done before? Why is this a big issue now? Common law rights have never been included in Sunrise processes before.
Okay, who suggested court-validated marks be included?
I can address it. This is Kathy.
Okay, Kathy.
NCSG is perfectly willing to go down the direction that Jeff just recommended, nationally registered marks from authorities, from jurisdictions that search. Absolutely fine. Where court-validated marks came in was that the staff report talks about common law verification, sending in the label, the bottle. You've heard me talk about this now many times. So that someone, perhaps continents away, can verify some common law right. And what we went back and thought about was who verifies common law rights, and ultimately in common law jurisdictions it's the courts. So if you had a court verification of a common law right and it happens in disputes, then we thought, you know, as a compromise position, then go ahead and submit that to the clearinghouse. But if there is consensus that people don't want that, then let's go with the nationally registered marks.
Okay. Margie?
Oh, I didn't have my hand raised.
Okay, you got a little microphone there.
It would be good to. It's Alan. It would be good to know why staff added them, if there is indeed a reason or not.
There were a couple. This is Amy. There were a couple comments. I don't know that anyone's wed to it, but the idea was that there were a few comments with respect to those that aren't simply registered, but there are some jurisdictions, certainly Western jurisdictions, that if you've used your trademark for, you know, a period of time, certainly have some very valid rights to that, and so that was the reason for including it.
Okay. I see Jeff Newman has a hand up, and Jeff Eckes has a microphone up.
So this is Jeff Newman. My recommendation then is, my motion is, take away the term common law rights, take away court validated mark. If yes, the common law, people who have common law rights have rights, but they can enforce that through a court. They can enforce that through the UDRP, I think. Someone could correct me if I'm wrong. So they have the protections they need. If they're not going to go out of their way to just register a mark, then why do we need to give them extra privileges under this system?
Okay. Anyone disagree with that view, that proposal?
John, this is Mark.
Okay, Mark.
One of the points that the IPC has made a few times is not really in contradiction of that, but we recognize that in the past registries have considered other kinds of rights or other kinds of interests when they've issued it, such as corporate names within the UK, that somebody operating a German registry might want to deal with rights that are recognized in Germany. And the IPC's suggestion and view is that the database should be able to accommodate that if it's something that the registry chooses. That would make...
I mean, the registry may choose to do a lot of things, right? So this can't be the be-all, end-all for everything a specific registry might choose to do. So we've got to reach the least common denominator, at least. And then if the registry chooses to do that on its own, it can.
I appreciate that, John. The IPC suggestion was that this clearinghouse be able to accommodate other data that registries find relevant to what they need to do.
Okay. Alan?
I haven't thought about that a lot, but my gut feeling is if something is allowed and is only used by certain registries,
that might be acceptable, but I certainly wouldn't want to put a mark in there which has to be used by all the registries who use the clearinghouse for, you know, things like common marks. And I would want to make sure that if common marks are validated, that the fees are set accordingly. Other people should not be paying for that service if they're not using it.
Okay. All right, any more comments on number 8? It sounds like we're getting close to consensus. It sounds like Jeff's proposal got a number of folks that that agreed with that. But let's work through that issue as we go on. Number 9. Post-launch IP claim service. What? You want to explain this one? Zane?
Yes, hi. Glutton for punishment. Absolutely. This is, again, as I said earlier, this is a BC position where the members think that it makes sense to have IP claim services available in an automated fashion post the launch of the GTLD. I also see the ALAC comments where they've disagreed with the IRT and said it is better to, you know, basically take action after the fact. So we would agree with that as well. So at least two groups on the call basically agree that both launch IP claim service could work. And this is just a start off the discussion.
Alan, I'll go to you next. Are you guys, ALEC, supporting the post-launch IP claim service?
We're certainly not demanding it, but we think it would significantly enhance the whole process. I understand it's more work. But if there's a reason for sending out an IP claims notice on a pre-launch registration, we see no reason not to do it afterwards. The IRT statement saying there are watch services available and the URF covers it, I think is addressing something after the fact, and it's better to catch it ahead of time and, from the point of view of the trademark holder, get someone to acknowledge that the mark domain they're registering is not a violation of the trademark. We're certainly not adamant about it, but we think this is something that we should significantly consider. On the other hand, it can be added after the fact, and it's not a decision we need to make immediately.
Sure. One of the questions the board asked this group to look at is the chilling effect on registration. So can you address that? Is that a concern for you post-launch?
It's certainly a concern. You know, I'm in the unusual position of taking the position of the trademark holders in this point. I think overall it would be a good thing. It depends, of course, how these notices are worded, and that's a factor. But okay. We're not adamant, and it can be added after the fact, so I'm not sure. It's an issue we need to discuss.
I've got Jeff Newman.
Yeah, so, God, where do I start? I think you said two groups support it. I think there are two groups here that vehemently oppose it, which is the registries and the registrars. I will also note that the IPC in its statement, and maybe Paul could speak to it, but I did notice in the IPC statement that they said that they did not support a post-launch IP claim, that it says that, in fact, the answer to number one, they specifically say that there could be no chilling effect because it's only pre-launch, and then they say, they talk about later on that it should only be pre-launch, that it's not feasible to do after launch. So I think it's really just the business constituency that's really asking for it, and it sounds like at-large thinks there may be some merit, but I got to tell you, we're never going to get consensus on this one. And I just had an hour-long call with a couple of people before this explaining why it's not feasible, and I could do it again, but I'm not on this call.
Okay. All right. Mike?
John, it's Mark. I'd like to comment on it. You can put me in.
Sure.
Well, I mean, Jeff, you know, sorry, but just saying it's not feasible, I'm not buying it, obviously. So you're going to need to give some better explanation than that. I've asked you for it a couple of times. We've talked about it. You know, it doesn't seem to me very difficult for a registrar or a registry to do a simple database query during the registration process. You're already verifying a credit card. You're already doing a lookup register database. You can look it up against the clearinghouse database. From that, really, the registrar or registry doesn't have to do anything other than that. the clearinghouse could be, we could be handled outside of the registration process. That's certainly up for discussion. Whether, you know, once the registrar does its core job, only job of querying this database, you know, it could step out. At that point, the clearinghouse could send a notice directly to the applicant for the domain name, and the applicant could have a later, you know, a period in which to cancel the name if they get a notice like that. Or, I mean, I think the better way is that the registrar and the clearinghouse and the contents of the clearinghouse notice would be worked into the registrar process. But I understand that modification to your process. So take it outside of there if you need to. But saying that it's not feasible and leaving it at that is just not going to be a good enough answer.
So would those people that I was on the call with this morning for an hour like to go into some of the reasons I explained? Mike, I'm not just saying it's not feasible. What I'm saying is that we have such a short call. I'd be happy to explain it to you. I spent an hour before explaining it to other people, and it's not just a matter of querying a database. It's a ton more than that. You're querying the database, but you're relying on external parties in doing an entire registration process. Yes, when you query a credit card company to see if a credit card has sufficient funds or has the ability to make a charge, that's a one-way communication with a one-way answer, yes or no, back. You're talking about multiple steps when you're talking about querying a database, getting the information, doing the match, sending out a notice, waiting for the notice, ensuring that the notice gets to from the registry, through the registrar, to the registrant, getting the notice back to make sure that they proceed with the registration, putting registrations on hold until you actually get those results back. But I can go into it for an hour or two if you want.
It's complicated just to make it complicated. It doesn't have to be nearly that difficult.
Well, you know what? Let me cut this off. I think, Jeff, you made a good suggestion that if folks want to discuss this offline, we could set up a separate call to discuss post-launch IP claims. I think, Mike, you're minimizing the impact to the registry and the registrars, and I don't think we will ever get consensus of this group on this issue, but, you know, it's fine to talk about it. But with 20 minutes left, with two topics left, I suggest we move on.
John, this is Kathy. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
What's the default here? What did staff report say on this?
Staff
pre-launch.
They did not have a post-launch IP claim service. Correct me if I'm wrong, Amy or Marjorie.
That's right.
Okay. And John, you're cutting off comments.
That's my suggestion. If people think we should spend the time, the remaining 20 minutes on this topic, that's fine. I'm happy to do that. My only suggestion is it sounds like if we get into the nitty-gritty of the details, it's going to take more than 20 minutes. I see a bunch of hands up, though, so...
Not mine. Know. Mine's down.
Okay.
I took mine down.
Okay. Alan, Paul, do you want to talk about this issue or do you want to move on?
I just have a very quick comment.
Go ahead.
Just that, as I said, it's something we can add later should it prove necessary. The other comment that was made is something that's not necessarily relevant to this, but interesting in that using it that way may, in fact, make the clearinghouse a viable business, whereas if we end up with a very small trickle of new GTLDs post the first batch, it may not be a viable business at all. But I don't think that's what we should be making our decision on right now.
Okay, Paul?
Yeah, just 2 seconds, because somebody asked me to speak to this. The IPC position has been what the IRT proposed. There would not be a post-launch claim service. However, again, that was all context of the mandatory. And if it's not going to be mandatory, then, I think the IPC's position on this particular issue has to remain a little bit agnostic until we get that issue tacked down.
Fair enough. Okay, Kathy, you just raised your hand.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I was also on the call with Jeff earlier today, and what I found very interesting was the the philosophical approach that, that Jeff brought, that you don't want, he didn't want IP claims to be a click-through agreement, that he designed it to allow time for the notice to go to the potential registrant, for the registrant to have time to review it, to consider it, maybe to consult an attorney, to look at the trademark rights that were asserted. And I found that discussion compelling and revealing, and I hadn't really thought it through before.
Okay, Vahid.
Thank you. Two quick points. One, if basically it's only going to be pre-launch, just wanted people to think about this. If I'm a bad actor, all I'll make sure is that I'll just register it after the GTLD has been launched, then effectively making IP claims redundant. And then so everybody, all the bad guys, is just going to do this afterwards. So then you just want to look at the IP claim service as a whole and say, really, does it actually catch the bad actors? So that's one point. The second is, in any case, I do think that this is something that could be discussed in further detail off the call. I had a discussion with you guys who did this, who have seen how that thing functions. And if we can take this off the, offline and have them make a presentation or take us through some of this, that would be great.
Okay.
Sorry, who were the guys? This is Jeff Newman. Who did you have a discussion with? The get.... Which
Laga? Laga.de? Yeah, Bart?
Bart? They never did an IP claim.
Yeah.
No, they have not. They designed a system. They've designed a system, not for a post-launch, but they've designed a system. But that's, there's been no other TLD other than .biz that has actually launched an IP claim system at this point in real life.
Okay.
That's true, and I know the .biz, okay, sorry. We'll take this off.
All right, let's move on to number 10. Okay, it sounds like there's close to consensus, but there's some clarifications. Kathy, do you want to take those, or Constantinos?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I hope others will jump in as well. There have been some discussions offline about how to minimize the chilling effect, how to create a notice that is useful for trademark holders, useful to say, not just maybe, International Class 9, we claim a mark in International Class 9, but a notice that really provides a discussion of the jurisdictions in which the mark is registered, of the description of goods and services of the mark, and then some kind of notice, as Mike actually raised earlier, which says you may or may not be infringing on this. If your use is non-commercial or it's fair use, consider going forward. So... anyone who would like to get together to draft a notice that's useful for both sides, come join the party because some of us are trying to do it offline.
Okay, that's helpful.
Yeah, I just want to jump in. But Kathy and I are working on this together, and I was supposed to have a draft for circulation by this call, but because of my trip to Miami, I got messed up. But hopefully she and I will have something for all of us to look at very soon, and if anybody else wants to help us, by all means, it's an open invitation.
That'd be great. So that was Paul?
Yes.
Okay. So people contact Paul and Kathy if you want to get involved in the folks working on the informal group working on this one. I still have a cue, though. Alan?
Yeah. At large had two comments. The first is I'd like to have an explanation of what the concept of a binding notice means. I think what it means is that the interaction and the response be something that could be referenced later in a URS to say, you said it wasn't going to, that this wasn't infringing, but clearly it is. And if that's what binding notice means, we support it. But the sentence itself doesn't parse properly. And the second one is, the notice must go out in the same language as the registration, the attempted registration is going on in whatever context that is.
Okay, so Paul, will you take that? Paul and Kathy, would you take that into those points into consideration in your group?
Yes, we will.
But I would like somewhere along the way for someone to tell me what they meant by the word "the notice is binding."
Well, I don't know what that means, but I think what we're trying to do is to develop a notice that's effective, that it
that it conveys the information that needs to be conveyed and that it's not unduly intimidating, and that it provides information for the potential domain registrant to reach out to open a dialogue with the brand owner if they think they should do that. So I think it's what we don't want is an oversimple notification that doesn't contain the appropriate information, or do we want something that's so large and confusing that if it came down to it, a URS panelist or a UDRP panelist or a judge would look at it and say, you know, this thing's 15 pages long. It's nonsense. Who knows what this means? And so I think that's just our way of saying that the notice needs to be in balance and it has to convey just the right amount of information and not anything that's extraneous or anything that's unnecessarily threatening.
Sounds good.
Should we change the wording on this then, that the notice is a balanced one?
I like the word effective.
Balanced and effective one. Okay, good. And, Alan, maybe you can join us in these. You and Olivia can join us in the calls because it's on the notice work, because we'd love to have you.
Oh, good. I had no more work to do.
I've got you.
Yes, I think that I didn't hear who was speaking before, and I think it was Paul, and I would just like to add that we need to understand that the purpose of the clearinghouse is to be efficient. It needs to be efficient for registries, for registrants, for trademark owners, for all parties concerned, and having very clear information that extends beyond this is a class 9 or this is a class 25, so as to inform registrants, is very important. So I think this is a very crucial point that we need to have.
Okay.
And I am up. I can sign on for the group for the notice to work on the notice.
Great. Jeff Newman.
Yeah, so this is just a point. Yesterday I sent around, it's called IP Claim Doc, which is an actual notice of what we sent out in .biz. So I would hope that people read that and use that as a starting point so you don't have to start from scratch. Again, I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying it's even good or great. But don't start from scratch. You guys have a sample out there. And if people want to comment on that, I'd recommend that so that we can streamline in this process a little bit, because I'm interested to hear what people think about it, because I do think it contains all the information, and I know I sent it separately to Kathy and Paul and Constantino, so I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that notice. And again, I do believe that when we sent that notice out, we did review it with WIPO, and they were happy with it.
Okay, great. All right, so that group will report back to the larger group, hopefully, by next week. And then looks like the last topic we have is number 11, and it doesn't look like there's any objection to this one. There's one blank in here. What is that, the IPC? So the IPC, do you want to talk about this issue?
John, it's Mark.
Hey, Mark. Go ahead. Thanks.
That our position on that is we support 11.
Okay. So it sounds like we have consensus on number 11. Excellent.
Great.
All right. That's a good start. So it sounds like there are a couple of subgroups working on a couple of the issues, specifically number 10, and if folks want to have a dialogue on number 9, that's fine. And then, so the question is anyone willing, I guess after the subgroups come back, willing to pull together a straw man proposal on this clearinghouse concept? If you think that was helpful to do in the one I circulated for URS.
I haven't seen that. It's Alan. I haven't seen that yet, but I'm willing to work on this one.
Okay. So maybe that same subgroup could, it sounds like it has a good cross-section, maybe that, you could take on the two issues, solving number 10 and maybe coming up with a straw man or something.
Wait, did you just nominate us, John?
I was just asking if you're willing.
John, I mean, maybe we should get together and have some discussions about number 9 also.
Yeah, I mentioned 9, that we could have a subgroup on 10 and a subgroup on 9. I'm sure Jeff Eckhouse would be happy to represent registrars on that one.
Thank you for the nomination, John.
So Mike, would you be willing to arrange a call on number 9, and then it's up to Kathy and Paul arranging something on number 10?
Yes, I'm glad to be with number 9. I think Jeff Newman should be there as well.
Yes. Jeff, you won't do that, I presume.
I thought I could avoid that one.
Okay. And then, so next steps, we've got a couple minutes left. I guess we'll do a doodle for calls next week on both topics. If there are online discussions on URS, that's great. If there are, reports back from any of the subgroups that are working on some of these clearinghouse issues, that's great too. And then folks raised the issue of a face-to-face meeting yesterday, and staff was looking at that, whether it made sense or not. Do folks still think that's necessary or something that would be beneficial? And it's only been a day, so I don't know if and I think Marjorie has dropped the call, so I don't know if you guys on the staff level have looked at that at all or not, or looked at that concept, Kurt or someone.
Yeah, this is Amy. I don't know if Margie has done that or not, so I'll touch base with her.
Okay. Okay, so we'll look for a doodle for calls next week. I'll be out there part of the week, but available later on. Hopefully we can move forward. And again, if folks could look at that URS, it's definitely a rough draft, so if people have comments, let's start talking about it.
What are we doing scheduling new next calls?
They're going to send out a doodle for calls for next week.
Yeah, I point out next week is our last week for the formal deadline set by the JNSO. Actually, today is next Monday is the week is the deadline if we're going to get something into the meeting ahead of time, which is the formal requirement.
This is Jeff. Should we be making a formal request for more time?
I think so, since Monday is the deadline that we can't. Next Monday is the deadline, which we clearly are not ready to meet.
I'd agree. This is Zahid. I completely agree with that.
So how much more time do we think we need?
Well, the board deadline is the 14th.
The 14th of December,
which means the GNSO would have to make a decision by then or a day or so before then, a week before that, so the constituencies have an opportunity to look at it, really means our output, we have to have our work finished by no later than the 4th or the 7th of December if the GNSO will schedule a special meeting.
Is Kurt still on the call? Is there a chance to informally float the idea with the board of extending that deadline?
Why do we need to extend the board deadline?
Well, I'm just not sure of...
I mean, the board deadline is a month from now.
Well, right, but to go through all the processes we need to go through.
This is Marika. Kurt has dropped off the call.
I mean, the board deadline is pretty arbitrary. I'm not saying we would take that much more time, and I'm not trying to delay the process, but inevitably the process is delayed itself with all the other things that are going on. I can't imagine asking the board to move its deadline out a month or so is going to do anything to the process.
Yeah, I mean, we're what? 5 weeks away from the board deadline. I don't know if it's appropriate to ask the board at this point for let's make some progress, and then once we show some progress, I think the folks would be more likely to be a little more flexible.
I would say if the GNSO is going to delay its deadline, even keeping the board deadline, it's going to take a while to schedule a meeting with the complexity of scheduling meetings in the GNSO. I think we need to start that soon if it's going to happen. Just having watched how difficult it's been to schedule next Monday, Monday the 23rd meeting.
You know, we could do a progress report for the GNSO on the 23rd.
Yes, but they will not be able to answer the board formally unless they schedule a meeting to do it.
Well, we should encourage the GNSO to schedule a meeting, you know, the week of December.
You know what? I think
that is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I just don't think, you know, that the council has an obligation to respond, you know, by the specific deadline, specifically when it's in December. You know, I think we'll just do it at our next meeting when we can. What's the board going to do? Fire us?
I have a whole bunch of ideas.
I think the issue should be raised on the council list.
Yes. Yeah, do we have a council liaison?
We certainly have counselors on here.
Zahid or Alan or Mike or who else is on the council?
Zahid is giving me an update on the 23rd, so that's you, Zahid.
Actually, at that point, the meeting was going to be held at a different time. So, David may in fact decide to do it, but if not, it's Zahid.
Okay.
He's going to post something on the council list to, give a short update of where we are and
why we need them to schedule another meeting.
Exactly.
Okay. Should I just simply say that we're looking for more time and do we have an idea of how much time we need? I mean, a couple of weeks.
I think we're looking for more time from the council.
Yeah.
I think
how
council,
much more time do you think that is?
Council needs to be willing to make the decision very close to the board deadline and subtract a week from that, and that's when we need the meeting to be. That's right. When our deadline is. So...
Okay.
We need a council meeting very close to the end, which probably means Monday the 14th.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So we've hit. Looks like it's about the ending time of the meeting. Anyway, any final comments? If not, we'll adjourn the meeting and look for the doodles for the next meetings.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone.
Zahid, if you put something out, the rest of us on this call will quickly support it, hopefully, and we'll get something going.
Thank you. We'll do that. Thank you.
John, thanks for sharing.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
Yeah. No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you
all. Great meeting.
Great. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.